This is CliffCentral.com.
Bob Skinstad represented the South African national team and played 42 tests for the Springboks between 1997 and 2007, captaining the side in 12 of those matches. It was a very tidy career. He also played in the positions of flanker and number eight while in there, and a Rugby World Cup winner in 2007 in France. It's really nice to talk to you, Bob, and to catch up. It feels like you're still on the field if I blink my eyes. Do you hanker for anything about that life now that you've moved on, you live abroad, you're running businesses, you're doing a lot of different interesting things? Is there anything about that rugby livelihood that you miss?
Gareth, I think there are a lot of things. First of all, it's great to catch up and see you. I've been in SA a couple of days now around the sevens and stuff, and there was so much positive thinking. I think I was feeling like I was missing out. They'd done so well in Dubai, and they did so well in Cape Town. You know, New Zealand, congratulations to them. But the Blitzboks are just playing this amazing type of rugby, and the fans are so behind them that I did feel a very sort of jealous and nostalgic all at once, you know. So I miss that bit. I miss the success on the field and the fun times you have with really good friends. You know, it's sharing a change room with guys is an easy way to make lifelong friends. So I miss that bit, but I've still got those friends. So I'm really lucky.
I'm sure you do. And also, when you come to South Africa, it's very hard for you to forget that part of your life because everybody knows who you are. And in England, I don't think everybody knows as much who you are as here. So it feels very different, right?
It does feel different. You know, you've got to take the good with the bad. I've always said that stopping for an autograph or a picture or something like that is just part of the little tax that you've got to pay, you know, because the public are what make a career in sport in the public eye something that you can actually earn a living out of, you know. I sort of straddled the oncoming professionalism of rugby, but I still owe everything to the fans who watched, you know. Some of them watching hoping I would fail, and some of them watching hoping that we would do well. But you know, when you're in South Africa, they still recognize you. I'm lucky in the hamlet of Weybridge in the UK, not as many people recognize me. But then my little son plays rugby, so I go and watch on a Sunday, and there's a lot of Yapi accents around that part of the world, and I have to have a lot of chats explaining away Springbok rugby on that side as well.
Yeah, I mean, you also have, you sort of, when you've moved on from something like that, it feels like you're being pulled backwards sometimes when you get into long conversations about it. And you do have lots of other things that are keeping you busy right now. What conversations would you rather be having?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I don't begrudge those conversations because I'm still a rugby fan through and through, and I watch it and I love it. But I've also, you know, for me, I've got into business and I've had to try and survive in that space as well. So I look up to business men and women, and I want to have talks with them about their successes and you know, pitfalls and swings and roundabouts of working in different types of business in different markets. And they might want to have a chat with me about how well Eddie Jones is doing with England. So I've got to try and steer it my side, but sometimes I've got to give a little and talk about rugby at present. So I would rather be talking about business. Maybe I'd rather be talking about junior rugby now than senior rugby, because it interests me to watch these youngsters play. My son's involved. I don't coach his team or anything like that, but I do watch these youngsters, and watching them develop is very fulfilling.
Tell me, if you walk into a room full of businessmen, do you ever get the impression that they think you're just a rugby player? And when you walk into a room full of rugby players, do you get the impression now that they think that you are some high-flying businessman? I mean, is it that dichotomous, or is it easy for you to overlap those magisteria?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think they are extremes. And I would say that you know, it's something you can never really shake. You know, I love it now. I mean, I retired more than 10 years ago, and I walked into the airport when we arrived in Cape Town. And old Tunny said, "Oh, Bobby, you know, are you still playing? where are you playing now?" Yeah. You know, 10 years is a bit extreme for her not to know that I'm not playing. But,
I know, it irritates me after 3 years, people saying, "So which radio station are you on?" I feel your pain. And I've only had to deal with it for 3 years, so I can only imagine.
Well, exactly. And so there are like I said, extremes. But then a lot of people are also, I mean, you know, they see some of the other things you're doing, and we've had little events companies, and we've had, you know, stakes in businesses that other people might have. The first time they interacted with me was in that, not in a rugby environment. So it's definitely, I feel, starting to mix. It's getting a little bit more cloudy, which I suppose for me, the cloudy is good for now.
Well, yeah, it is. But you want to avoid stereotyping. And I suppose this is true for anybody because, you know, the business people don't necessarily know as much about business as they think they do. I mean, this whole thing that happened with Steinhoff here in South Africa last week, you must have been watching the Sevens and seeing that logo and thinking, God, that's ironic, because here you are as a businessman. And all the business people thought that they could get involved with rugby, and the rugby people think they can get involved in business. And what you learn from each other is that actually there are no surefire answers, and the world is changing so fast, and there's so many things going on, that actually it doesn't matter what you did before. If you're really interested and driven in what you're doing now, it almost feels like you could make more difference than ever before.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. I think you're so right about how fast the world is moving. I mean, I really feel sorry for millennials coming through now. You've seen all the stats on, you know, half the jobs that they're going to have don't exist now.
Yeah.
How do you prepare? Well, for me, it's about being smart about the decisions you make now, so that you are a malleable character, so that you are someone who can change, you know, and someone who can set a path for yourself quite quickly. I mean, I see from the business side, and you're right. I mean, the whole Steinhoff saga is a tough one because We've put everybody up in these ivory towers. You know, everyone on that side are successful businessmen. I mean, the rugby might even be the same. You know, if you're a winning team, do you win all the time? No, there's ups and downs.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things I have learned from rugby is that, you know, fair weather friends are the same in sport and in business.
Yeah.
So it's good to surround yourself with quality people, highly skilled, and character is more important than anything, you know, but in particular than reputation, because, you know, for me, character is what you really are, and reputation is what others think you are. So if I traded on my reputation and I tried to sell you anything from a calculator to a property development, you'd still be seeing me as a rugby player, and I'd be out of place for you. But if I walked into the room and I said, I've come in here because you've got a level of trust with me, and I've brought along the best X, Y, or Z person in the world because I can recognize excellence, you transfer the trust very quickly from me.
Yeah.
And you go, wow, that guy, you know, if I said, here's my friend Gareth, he is, you know, the a pioneer in digital radio and podcasting in South Africa, the guy's never not going to trust me that I've recognized excellence in you. But if I say, hey, I've got a huge podcast, you know, let me connect your headphones, they're going to go, whoa, I don't want a clumsy rugby player running my the back end. So that's a big learning for me, you know. So I try not to stereotype people too much and try and learn what I can from individuals. But you know, as I say that, I think to myself, how this landscape is so difficult to predict. I mean, you know, 3 months ago, we were singing the praises of individuals in both a rugby team and in corporate South Africa, and now that's changed. So we have to learn.
And once there were people singing the praises of Jacob Zuma, that's changed quite a lot too. But we won't even get into politics. Well, I'll move off of rugby in a second. You know, I'm not even a big rugby fan, so I'm asking you these things because I'm genuinely curious about the experience of what happens post-rugby. You have managed to, I know that you like the anonymity in some ways, and I know that business is really what turns you on now, but having got out of rugby and looking at it now with hindsight, do you think South Africans have an awkward and sometimes childish relationship, it's almost idolatrous. It's almost like they look to these rugby players, and this is white people, black people, young people, old people. I mean, you know, corporate success stories, people who've made huge money that actually grovel at the feet of rugby players because that's what they want it to be. And in South Africa, we really have this thing with sport. It's an abiding passion of ours, for good or for bad. And perhaps sometimes I do think it's unhealthy that we idol worship, because we've done it with politicians before and they've let us down. We've done it with business leaders and they let us down. And we've absolutely done it with sports people and they let us down. because it's ridiculous to expect another human mammal to do superhuman things all the time. And then you find yourself believing that it would be possible if you just got close enough to that person to be like that too. And you're disappointed when it doesn't happen. Do you have those thoughts?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think there's some interesting things in what you said there. You know, the one thing you have to remember is that people live vicariously through others in the main, you know, not everybody. And look, it's a really strong person that doesn't at least engender a little bit of good, positive thinking when someone else that they look up to does well. So let's take it in that context. The Springbok rugby team has been the pinnacle of what South African rugby players,
sure,
you know, and rugby playing public. It doesn't matter what team you played or didn't play. You know, if your school, club, friends, group, whatever would talk about it, you would think about what it would like to be that person. And then what happens is people forget what you said, people forget what you did, but they never forget how you made them feel.
Right.
So in this environment, South Africa has had tremendous sporting success, and we're very lucky. We're very spoilt and very lucky. I mean, you know, we lost to Wales the other day, you know, for the third time in 70 years. You know, and a Welshman said to me, he said, "Do you think our rivalry is over? You know, now Wales will just sort of dismiss South Africa easily." I said, "Well, you know, 20 years ago, I was part of a team that beat Wales 96-13. You know, and I didn't go to a Welshman and say, "Do you think our rivalry is over?" Because it's never over. You know, there's going to be Welshmen who will support Wales forever. There will be people who support South Africa forever. But both of them have got this amazing love-hate relationship with this team that governs how they feel. Because, you know, I mean, I don't know if you ever heard the stat, but after the All Blacks lost their test matches in the mid-90s, there was a huge uptick in domestic violence in New Zealand.
Really?
On those Saturday nights, there was a big call out, and the police said that the stats, they actually ran a campaign, an anti-abuse and victimization campaign, because people would get angry and bash family members when the All Blacks had lost. And I mean, it was a huge learning for me as to that's how much people care. So I get it. You know, I get what people live and breathe this by. I do think you have to try and separate yourself, but it's hard. I mean, I've seen this passion for football teams in the UK. My goodness.
What
we get put through as rugby players in South Africa is nothing compared to that. So maybe we just got to thank our lucky stars and smile and carry on.
All right. You've made sense of it for me, because I think from the inside, when you are the person that everyone's looking at, when you are the person that influences whether or not I have a bad or a good weekend, which obviously to someone like me sounds crazy, but it matters to somebody who might have a very ordinary life, and this is their moment to be passionate about something. It's their moment to jump in, you know, and live, whether it's vicariously or whether it's because it just gives them a thrill. And now I understand a little more. The pressure must be intense. I mean, when you walk out there, and even now, as Bobby Skjenstad, as this guy who kind of everybody in South Africa knows, was there pressure after you left to have to succeed? Was that a self-imposed pressure, or did you feel like there was any weight on you from the public, from this kind of unnamed mass of people who expected things from you?
Oh, no, there's huge pressure. I mean, I think there's pressure from the public anyway, and then there's pressure from yourself. You know, it becomes difficult to separate. And I think, I mean, it's something that is being addressed now in the UK. I'm seeing it more and more there. And I think in South African rugby and South African sport, the guys are starting to realize, you know, that a life under that much pressure, I mean, stress is a massive killer, mm-hmm. you know, of yeah. people, you know, there's a huge link between stress and, you know, early onset of dementia, motor neuron,
cancer,
all these kind of things. And we say it, we pay it lip service in a manner, because I don't think we do enough about it. But the ex-players are now starting to realize it. So they've been, you know, I wouldn't say it's like a support groups, but there's sort of been a bit of rallying from older players who've maybe made it through a difficult time. And now they're almost coming out of that difficult time and warning younger players, listen, You know, remember when everything in your whole life revolves around wearing a flippin' jumper on a Saturday, it becomes a long and lonely month when you have no games on a Saturday and no one's cheering your name, at least for those little sort of breaks. You know, there's a huge period of indifference and negativity from the public if you're not the idolized player anymore. And some people take that completely the wrong way. I know I've had really up and down times myself, and I've had to sort of almost self-manage my way out of that because I think it's a dangerous place to be. If you're more we lost a very close or a wonderful rugby player and a close friend, Dan Vickerman, last year, who committed suicide, just saying, you know, it's just too much for me not to be something every week.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's a huge loss, you know, and it's not an isolated example either. So, yes, there is. But then also, like I said, you know, paying the tax of signing an autograph or whatever it is also means that for the rest of your life, you'll be able to engage in a conversation with someone, even if you start with rugby. That's okay. You know, you start with rugby, you learn a little bit, you're having a conversation. I mean, people afford you the time of day, you know, and I mean, that's a ticket to survival in this world these days. So I think it's a compromise, but it's one that's definitely advantageous for an ex-sportsman.
Now, you've been involved in a lot of things, and I don't know where to start with this, but let's start with the charities and the organizations that you've been a part of and that you've helped found. I mean, the Put Foot Foundation, the Ernie Els Autism Foundation, Franschhoek Hospice. These are all quite divergent things. Is there a particular reason you're drawn to some and not others? Because it's a time commitment from you, and I would imagine there's also a lot of energy that you need to put into the things you really care about. What mechanism do you use to choose what gets your time and what doesn't?
Well, I mean, for me, it's about, and I think you know some of my stuff around trying to think in the 80-20 model. So yeah. it's where I can impact the most difference. You know, for me, the Put Foot Foundation started as a charity where we did some manufacturing of some shoes. And the shoes we used to give away to schools. We had some great corporate partners, etc. And then we realized, you know, that the consistent, difficult fundraising every year of pushing people to buy and to give, etc., was actually a stumbling block. So I partnered with a wonderful guy, Darren Hillhouse, from the Putfoot Rally, which is a really fun rally where he does the five countries in and around South Africa over about 17 days in July every year, and you sort of bring your own vehicle, and he manages all the checkpoints on the way, and it's just an incredible way to see the countries, the game parks, the time in between the checkpoints, about 3 or 4 days. So there's no real formula for where you have to be, except you've got to check in at the border crossings and stuff. But what he does is, because he generates a lot of media around it, he says each team has also got to contribute to charity. So then we raise a large amount every year through those contributions and donations. And then on the trip, we give away shoes, which we have manufactured, and we give away shoes to schools in every single African country. Hmm. So we give away the ones that we go through. So it's a wonderful way of turning the thinking on its head and saying, no, we're not going to have a big gala dinner. We're actually going to link a charity to an event which is going anyway. So that's right. Helped us a lot. And then, you know, Els for Autism is because Ernie, I think, is one of the most giving, amazing people. He does the same thing with his golf days. So he raises money by getting a corporate sponsor for a golf day, but he needs speakers and people to do the Q&As and all that stuff. And I love my golf, so I say to Ernie, I'll come and do that for absolutely nothing, and whatever we raise must go then to raising the profile of Els for Autism. He's built an autism-focused hospital, which I think is absolutely brilliant in the United States, and then he contributes to autism projects in a lot of the countries where he has the golf test. So it's about spreading, you know, for me, the smaller bits that we do with a multiplier effect, mm-hmm. the better, you know. And the Franschhoek Hospice, Robin Jackman is a commentator on Supersport, and he's raised money for them over the years. His wife is involved there, and he lived down the road from me. So that's one where,
oh, cool.
where I would jump in to help him out any day of the week. He's done the same for me. And I think it's wonderful when sportsmen and women are able to give back like that.
It is terrific. Tell me about this 80-20 principle. I've heard of, I mean, this is something that's been bandied about by a number of people. The guy behind it was what Richard Koch, right? He was the guy who wrote this first. He wrote a book called The 80-20 Principle.
Yes, that's right.
So is this what I'm thinking it is? That the problem with most of us is that, and I've felt this in my own business sometimes, we spend 80% of our time focusing on 20% of the business when we should be... No, sorry, it's the other way around. We spend all of our time looking at all the stupid stuff when we should be focused on the 20% that makes us money and that really makes a difference and that we can make the most impact in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's easy to simplify it because Richard's done it so well. So I had a chance to meet him. Basically, he wrote the book. I mean, and he was a consultant with the Boston Consulting Group. He's a highly trained, highly qualified sort of business analyst.
Sure.
And he started to see the same sort of thing happening. So what he then read up about was there was an Italian economist who wrote, his name was Wilfred Pareto. So he wrote a paper called The Pareto Principle, which was effectively that 20% of the causes mm-hmm. create 80% of the outcomes. That's it. So it is business orientated in my context, and I'll get more into that. But basically, you will be astounded to find out how many times that has come up. So in Pareto's economic theory, he was going, so where else can I see this? Because he worked out that 80% of the land in Italy was owned by 20% of the people.
Right.
Then he did a study on the wealth, and he worked out that 80% of the wealth was owned by 20% of the people.
Isn't it true? He also found that, like, in his own garden, the peas, the pea pods actually produced the majority of peas.
So what he did then is he then said, where else can I find a way to prove this? And he was in his garden, literally, he grew peas.
Yeah.
So he then did a study, and all the pea pods, in varying different sizes, 20% of the pea pods held 80% of the peas.
Wow.
You know, and then that got him onto it. He was like, wow, where else does this work? And, I mean, you won't believe it, but every single part of my life, I've been able to look at that. So I was a young rugby player, and I read this book. I'd actually been overseas on a trip, and I picked it up at the airport. The first sort of edition came out, I think, the late 80s, and I picked it up in sort of 92, I think, and read it. And I've applied it to almost every part of my life. Like, you can't believe we turned around a team called the Stormers, which 20 years ago had been disqualified for from Super Rugby. We had to go back and qualify through the night series. And I went to the coach and I said, you know what? I'm going through the numbers here, and if we 80-20 this, if we get the guys who have got the speed and the talent to score tries, if we get them the ball, you know, more times, we get higher results. So we actually engineered ways to get the ball in the hands of the fast, quick guys in space more often. It was incredibly effective. So, I mean, you know, a couple of years later, I bought into a restaurant chain. We worked out after a while. I said, well, what, you know, we've got a 36-page menu. And the thing that clicked it for me, there was a tomato tart, which was on the menu. You know, I don't like tomato tarts. And I was like, you know, why have we got a tomato tart? And they said, no, when we bought it, the owner used to love it. So I said, well, how many people have ordered over the last year? I don't know. Well, let's look at the till slips. So we recorded over 4 months. And we didn't sell one. But the ingredients of a tomato tart take up, you know, you've got to have preservatives, and you've got to have canned tomatoes and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And they took up about a square meter in our storeroom. And I said, like, if you do the maths on this, this thing we never sell is actually taking up a chunk of our space, and it's not contributing to revenue. So we cut this menu down from 36 pages down to 2 pages, and only thing we put into the menu was the 20% of the things that we'd found out from the till slips that 80% of the people ate. It was actually 82% of people ate 18% of the things on the menu.
Jeez. So then you save a fortune and you make far more money.
You save a fortune. Yeah. Exactly. Now, the funny thing on this, and so then I've started saying, okay, well, where else? As Richard does, and Richard's gone on to write incredible books, Simplify, The Star Principle,
yes.
You know, and it's all about applying this principle to relationships, to sales pipelines, to, you know, what you do with your time. I mean, to be honest, we all waste too much time because we don't actually prioritize. And I just started to say, well, sure, but maybe we can prioritize that. But you've got to teach people to prioritize, because it's very easy to sit there for 20 minutes, half an hour. Suddenly it's 2 hours that you've been on your social media and you've forgotten to go and do just the two tasks which would have actually made your whole day different.
Someone said to me last night, funnily enough, that success is actually in small victories, like getting out of bed and making your bed. And for many people, you know, they kind of start their day and they go, I don't know if I can get out of bed. If you get that first thing out of the way, the rest sort of feels like a breeze. And I suppose with those two tasks that you're talking about, instead of spending hours on social media, you do the two things that you needed to do on your to-do list. And before you know it, you've got all this time.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not going to advocate jump off social media because I love social media.
Yeah.
But I say to myself, don't jump onto my phone at flipping, you know, 6:30 in the morning when I get up, because the 20 minutes that I'm reading social media, then I'm now late for my school run for my kids and I'm rushed and I'm in a bad mood, etc. So
hey,
I leave
listen,
it.
Listen, but by the way, four kids. How are you managing with that?
Listen, I'm married to the most incredible woman. She makes it seem a breeze. I sometimes don't even notice that there's four. But when we're staying in South Africa and we're visiting friends and family and I'm suddenly running the Lift Club again, I do realize, because I've got to go and get them to visit all their South African mates and all that kind of thing. And it's been an interesting diary preparation for
now,
the next 2 weeks.
I'm doing a little bit of maths here. Which kid are you spending all of your time on? Because 80-20 rules must apply here, so that three of them you can ignore. is that true for children? I mean, do you see it in their behavior? Do you see it in the way that you're raising them, what you have to spend time with them doing? I mean, I'm being facetious about the four kids and the 80-20, but in fact,
I think you're so right.
You have to apply
20,
it, right?
20% of what anybody does affects 80% of their lives. Things like manners and understanding of discipline, contributing to other people, those are a small part of your day. I promise you, if you get those right, the rest will never have to unravel.
That's interesting.
So for me, with the kids, I want them to see me treating their mum right. I want them to see me working hard in my business. I want them to see me spending time with them whenever I can, in an environment where we're both enjoying ourselves. It's not all about, you know, me doing only their stuff. We have a lot of storytelling and fun stuff that we do as a family, and that those little bits of time are for me the most precious.
You mentioned stress earlier. Can you manage stress? Can you alleviate those things that get people caught up in stuff they shouldn't get caught up in, that makes them unhappy, with this 80-20 rule as part of the principle?
Well, I'll give you a great example. I've got a tremendous friend of mine, Mark Ward, and I had a chance to play a round of golf with him the other day. And he said to me, oh, what do you think we're going to do about the Proteas cricket team now? So I said, well, I don't think anything about that. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I love the Proteas. I support my cricket. I'm a cricket tragic. I wake up at 4 a.m. to watch the Ashes,
yeah.
You know, and I'll watch anyone play cricket. But I can't govern who's running the Proteas. It's got nothing to do with me. So I said, I watch the cricket that I want. I take my enjoyment out of it, and I don't read a single article about who's in charge, who's not in charge, whether they're the right people, etc. Because it has nothing, and it'll only contribute to my stress. If I think that they're the wrong people, you know, then what stress am I going to take into my next task? And right now my next task is trying to hit this putt. So can you please keep quiet so I can putt? we laughed about it, but I promise you it makes the difference. If 80-20 is all about control the controllables.
Yeah.
You know, and what we've done now is we've looked at you know, who would be affected by this. And I promise you, it's the millennials coming through, the people who next year are going to be looking for a job, the people who are going to be saying, okay, should I be doctor, lawyer, you know, coder, engineer, whatever? And they're going to forget that there are some incredibly highly paid vocations doing something else, because everything that they've done, or everything they've done, you know, to this point, has pushed them in the way that society wants to push them. And now all the people we find fascinating in life are the ones who push back at what society have told them, you know, and may create a path for themselves. So I love that, because I think then you're the thinkers. You know, are you involved in setting up something for yourself in the future, or a business in the future? Because if you're doing what everybody else wants you to do, only you are going to be unhappy in the future. And then when you change, then everyone else is unhappy, which makes you unhappy again. So, you know, I don't think that they're set up to make the decisions right at this stage.
You know, I've often thought about this 80-20 principle in respect of time efficiency. And I'm obsessed with time efficiency. I hate waiting. I hate being late. I hate keeping other people waiting. It drives me insane to the point where if a meeting is running on, I start getting fidgety and agitated, and, you know, I stop paying attention, and I become destructive, not even neutral. I become actively bad. And I was thinking, you know, if you've got 5 days in the week and the 80-20 principle applies here, then, you know, at least one of your days in that week, you should be doing as much as possible. And maybe if you can cut down on the wastage, you could spend two of them, which would get you to 40%. You might be able to be, you know, putting out 160% then in a week. And that would only be 2 days. Is it possible to do that? Is it possible to learn to use your time that efficiently?
Gareth, it is so possible. Let me just mention one word to you. Tim Ferriss.
Oh, yeah. But isn't he a smug arsehole? I mean, this guy says he knows everything. He's constantly telling you about how he's worked out all the secrets of the universe. He's one of those people who you'd hate to end up next to at dinner, because he's telling you everything that you're doing wrong and how great he is. I mean, doesn't that kind of person drive you crazy? I liked him. I listened to his podcasts. I used to be ambivalent. Then I became a fan. And then I sort of got bored with his me stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I mean, I think there's an element to that. I think there's an element to self-promotion in that game, because he's become a management guru, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like Tom Peters can go around telling everybody he's crap at what he does and get any gigs. He's got to tell people he's good. But I tell you, you know, I met him in Cape Town. I reached out to him. He was writing at the time The 4-Hour Body. He was doing some experiments with the Sports Institute in Cape Town.
Yeah.
And I found him to be very charming, you know, endearing, interested in what we were doing. I think he's got a personality outside of what he's, you know, the sort of self-promotion side of it. I would imagine that 2 hours with, you know, anyone in that space, if you think about Tony Robbins, yeah. I'm not sure I would want Tony Robbins careering around my lounge all day.
No.
But I'm happy to pick and choose some of his good thinking. But Tim Ferriss is a guy who, a highly educated guy, who actually did what you said. He didn't experiment on how to be more efficient. I still think his seminal work was the 4-hour work week.
Yes.
Where he taught people in the modern internet age to have a managed business where you needed to spend 4 hours a week and you could actually survive. And for me, that was what endeared him completely. Mm. To me and to other people, is that he's like, guys, the tools are there. You don't have to invent them. You just got to use them right, you know. And he's gone on into a more public profile, and that might be part of the narcissist approach.
It could also be just me being angry that I haven't figured out as much. You know, I'm willing to take that one on the chin, because you're absolutely right about the 4-hour work week. I think that was seminal. I think it changed for a lot of people the way that they thought about work. I met someone the other day who said to me, "What's the opposite of work?" And I thought about it for a while, and then she said, she works at Stanford University. She said, it's depression. Depression's the opposite of work. For most people, the opposite of work, the immediate reflex is to say play, right?
Yes.
But it's actually depression, because when you're living out your potential and you're being as efficient as you can with your time, you feel very stimulated. It feeds itself. When you're not working, when you're not useful, when you aren't doing anything that's got purpose, you get depressed, and I'm not a depressive person, but I imagine that that's what it must feel like.
Well, the most important word there you said was purpose. And I mean, we can debate for hours. I promise you, the different management gurus out there, people who've, you know, like yourself, done well in being able to talk to other people and to write about their theories that work for them and convey messages that impact people's lives. I think immediately of, you know, the idea of having flow. You know, mm-hmm. There was a McKaylee, was a writer who talks about, you know, when a sportsman or a businessman feels, wow, where did all the time go? I was working and I was enjoying type thing, that you're in a state of flow. So I would imagine that's a great way to talk about it, you know, because that once you find your purpose, you should be in that state all the time.
Yeah. I mean, you're stimulated, right? And you're firing on all cylinders and you feel like you can do anything.
Well, you feel like you can do anything, but you're also enjoying what you're doing. And it doesn't matter the level of work. You know, some people get it from carving a sculpture. Some people get it from attacking an Excel spreadsheet. You know, it's not specific, and it doesn't have to be a sport and doesn't have to be a business. Maybe that circles back to what we were talking about earlier. If you can connect a sportsman and a businessman, they both understand that. It might be in different spheres, but it's certainly transferable.
Now, what do you do to relax?
Well, I'm lucky. I love golf and I love my fishing. So I'm actually going fishing on the weekend in Lesotho with my little son. And my kids, on their 10th birthdays, we go away. Dad sort of nice. Facilitates a trip. And my son and I are going fishing in Lesotho with some friends. There's a community camp called Makangoa out there, and they've got some brilliant trout fishing and yellowfish fishing. I'm looking forward to spending some time out there. It's only 3 days, but we're really, really excited. I love fly fishing. That, for me, get into a state of flow. You know, out there at one with nature and having the time of your life. And don't worry, I don't pretend to be a catcher of fish. I'm an angler, so it's more fishing than catching with me. I'm not that good, but I do love it to bits.
Is it complicated to apply these things subconsciously? I mean, do you have to think about it all the time? When we talk about flow, I mean, this is something that I've been really interested in since I heard Tim Ferriss using it. I've heard a lot of other people using that term, flow, that when you're operating at maximum capacity and it seems like it's effortless and the stuff is happening. Is it difficult to get to that subconscious level where you don't have to think it through? You don't have to push from the back to make it happen.
Well, you know, so what we did, we've developed an e-course which encapsulates what it all is. Because people who don't know have real difficulty in saying, I mean, you would have Simon's, I'm not sure if it's Sinek or Sinek. You know, he's like, you know, start with why, and then the art of why, and then find your why. Mm-hmm. And why creates a purpose. Now, I think the problem is that it is difficult because people don't know how. So what we've done is tried to put together a few, you know, tools and quizzes and examples. You know, I spoke to various sportsmen and women, individuals, businessmen, and I said, can you give us some examples? So we've got a whole list of how somebody changed their life because they realized it was out of kilter. You know, so let's use the example of this person, this sort of no-name person that you and I are talking about, who doesn't really know what they're going to do for a living, etc. Like, how do they get to know what they're going to do for a living? And for me, you've got to analyze your life. You've got to spend some real time looking at your opportunities, your options, etc. And then you've got to have a decision-making framework. You know, so what is going to affect the rest of my life the most, and how do I get to do that? You know, there's got to be a couple of steps. Now I think once you do it enough times, it does become like, I don't go into any situation now without going, what's the 80-20 here? You know, this business that we are looking at, who are the 20% most profitable clients? Because what the hell are they doing chasing the other 80%? It's become my default state of mind. You know, and I heard a great story the other day about a financial manager in because, you know, once I'd chatted to my friend about this 80-20, And the Protea story that I was telling you about, he said, jeepers, that's amazing. I must look at that, because a friend of mine basically left his own business, left the rest of the business to other people, and took the top 20% of the clients. So he took the people who listened to his advice. He took the people who worked well with him. He took the people who held the most money with him. And he just became much more successful because he had more time to concentrate on those quality people. And now, if you're a young person, surely you want to join a business and do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, surely you don't want to say, well, I'm going to earn a wage. Imagine if you had, a young host coming onto your show and it was like, well, I'm not really going to prep that much because I'll do my 1 hour for Gareth in the day, and then I can't wait to bugger off and have my do my own business at home.
Correct.
You know, what about the person who goes, well, I'm going to work so hard on creating an audience, creating a following, creating an impact, that Gareth's going to go, well, you know, sheesh, we need to keep you. We need you part of the team. We want you to grow with us. You know, because then you're affecting your future. But if all you're doing is trying to get away with everything on every day, and we see that a lot, you know, because of the proliferation of these various forms of media, et cetera, people are going, well, you know, how can I get away with as much as possible in my corporate environment? As opposed to how can I contribute as much? And I think that's one of the big problems.
Do you think technology will help us?
Well, it has to. In form at the moment, it's quite confusing because everybody's selling themselves as the best way to help you. You know, is this CRM better? Is that getting things done course better? Is it phone management, diary management? You know, everybody's saying that, you know, you should be on these five things or those five things. And I worry. I think the application of technology must come way after your understanding of what you're trying to do. And for me, that means we need to spend a little bit more time thinking and less time just sort of doing. You know, Abraham Lincoln said years ago, and it's one of the quotes I've used for ages, he said, if I'm given 8 hours to cut down a tree, I'm going to spend six of them sharpening my axe. and you know, for me, that concept is great. You know, you don't want a guy operating.
It sounds almost like he should have been the guy who came up with the 80-20 rule. Hello?
Probably applied it in his life.
Yeah, it sounds like he probably did. It's like an early intuition. Bob,
exactly.
The line seems to be giving us some trouble, but I've taken up quite a lot of your time already. I hope you'll have a very good holiday and that you'll enjoy being with the kids and chilling for a little while. But if people want to find out more about the e-courses that you're doing, where can we go to find out? Especially if you're a millennial who's feeling a little dissatisfied with the world. You feel like you want to make a difference, make something happen, but you really don't know where to start. How can people begin this journey?
Thanks, Gareth. I mean, so we've put an e-course out. It's called the 80-20 Mindset, and it's on www.8020mindset.com. And, you know, most searches go straight there. We've got fantastic examples of players that I've played with that have changed the way, you know, the way they live, what they do, et cetera, by applying the principles of the course, and it gives you a really nice step-by-step guide to reassessing your life, having a look at your future, and becoming the contributor and the high-impact person that you can be, because we've all got it in us. So I'm delighted to chat to you about that today. Thank you, and anyone who goes there, welcome. I'm chatting on the forum, and the feedback will come from me on the blog and that kind of thing. So I look forward to chatting to anyone on the course.
Well, thank you for talking to us today. It's nice to speak to you, Bob, and keep well.
You too, and keep doing so well. Thanks, Gareth. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.